Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Kirk Megu, host of Politics and Polemics on the New Books Network. I also host my own podcast called Independent Thought and Freedom, where I interview some of the most interesting people from around the world who are shaking up politics, economics, society, and ideas. You can find it in the iTunes Store or on any one of your favorite podcast providers. You can also subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, are you an academic that wants to get heard nationally? Check out my free training on 3 steps how to use your intellectual authority to become a media personality at becomeapublicintellectual.com. That's becomeapublicintellectual.com. You can find the links below. And now, on to this week's episode. Hi, today my guest is Michael Rechtenwall, author of the book Beyond Woke, published in 2020 by the New English Review Press. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, Kirk. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to have you on. We've spoken before in other forums, so I know what kind of a very interesting discussion we can have and we have had before. As our listeners know, I am joining you from Trinidad and Tobago in the Caribbean. Where are you located right now?
Yeah, I'm in the south side of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Okay, right. Nice. Now, we always like to start off these interviews with you giving, telling us, the audience, a little bit more about your background, and particularly as it relates to this book. Can you do that for us?
Oh, sure. Well, first, I should say that I was an academic for 25 years. I've taught at numerous universities. I taught at Case Western Reserve University, Carnegie Mellon University. I taught at North Carolina Central University, Duke University, and finally at New York University, NYU. And I was a My background academically is in what's called literary and cultural studies, which is a program in English, and it's a very politically charged academic discipline. So I was basically indoctrinated, or I should say, I became very steeped in the theoretical underpinnings of socialism, feminism, postmodern theory, et cetera, et cetera. And I took that into my teaching, and it was basically informing my worldview as well.
Right. So now that's interesting. You were an advocate of a lot of these left wing cultural studies ideas. Did you call yourself woke at the time?
Well, that phrase wasn't out,
Yeah.
Even the phrase social justice wasn't really au courant at that time. And for example, something like toxic masculinity was not It was not a phrase in circulation during my academic studies. At that time, it was something like phallogocentrism, you know?
Phallologocentrism.
Phallologocentrism.
Right. Yeah. So it's as the ideology was morphing to what it is today, you found yourself at odds with it, and not only theoretically, but it affected it affected your professional life very seriously.
Yeah. When I became a critic at NYU of social justice ideology and identity politics and what we now call wokeness. I faced an immediate backlash from colleagues and the administration to the point where they pushed me onto a paid leave of absence, condemned me in an open letter in the student newspaper, basically tarnished my reputation forever in academia, and drove me to the margins of the university, moved my office to the Russian department. I was universally shunned by 100 faculty members in my department. I was pushed into what I called my own personal gulag in the Russian department, where they would not move my books. And I sat in an empty room with metal shelves, totally isolated.
Wow. And so that's really interesting, because it's not that, you know, you were a conservative, English scholar, that was constantly battling with the left. And, you know, so it's not just like another right winger conservative or Christian or some sort of privileged white male that your privilege is being taken away. This was something. So you were like one of them, and then because you asked difficult questions or you questioned certain things, that they just wouldn't have it. Is that it?
Yeah, that's right. I was farther left than the people that actually came out against me. At the moment that I made the critiques that I did, I was a left communist, you know, and these people were just identity politickers, you know, so I was actually further left than them. That's the real irony. So I critiqued identity politics. I said that the craziness of the identity politics of the left, for example, was an alt-right generator, you know? I was saying that it was generating the alt-right, in effect, by virtue of its own insanity and things like that. This is what they took real offense to.
Oh, wow. Like
that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it's parallel to a lot of other people on the left who've been criticizing identity politics, like Jimmy Dore, who I really love in the U.S. You have George Galloway in the U.K. with his Workers' Party, Brendan O'Neill from Spiked, who also was a Marxist, and they, you know, have a very heavy critique of identity politics. One, I think it was Brendan O'Neill, he said, you know, they allow every identity possible except your class identity.
Right.
And they allow they allow the class exploitation to continue, and it's sort of a mask for it. Would you say your criticism is kind of along those lines or a little
different? It was slightly different. I wrote as a Marxist, I wrote an essay called What's Wrong with Identity Politics? And my argument was that instead of liberating the people that were in the categories of the subordinated categories, that it actually served to reify the categories and actually solidify their containment within those categories, instead of liberating them from the categories, which I thought was the real objective. Because if the categories are the problem, then why not get rid of the categories themselves, instead of reinforcing them through grievance studies and things like that? After all, if people are, you know, in what's been called grievance studies since the article by, I should say, the big giant, you know, multiple spoof, sort of like the Sokol hoax redux of the three scholars, Pluckrose and Boghossian, and I forget the third guy. If in fact this is grievance studies, is if those scholars were, if those people that those scholars were writing about happened to be liberated from those categories, what would they have to do? Their enterprise would be kaput. So my point was, in that essay, What's Wrong with Identity Politics, and it's still up on my website, by the way, I argued that these that identity politics aimed only at the equality of the categories, supposedly, rather than what would be more important would be universal human emancipation, which would require liberation from the categories themselves.
Right. Now, you speak about liberation from the categories, and you know, people on that identity politics left, let's say, a lot of them speak about abolishing whiteness. Would you say that lines up with your project?
It would have, but the thing is that those people are effectively saying they want to abolish whiteness, but they don't want to abolish any of the other categories.
Right.
So they're trying to effect a kind of inversion of the social hierarchy. Whether they know it or not, that's what it would amount to, and that's what it is amounting to, an inversion ideology. It's an inversion ideology based on a kind of resentment, to use a Nietzschean expression. And they want to liberate people. They want to eradicate whiteness, I should say, without eradicating any of the so-called subordinate identities. Therefore, what they would end up with is merely a kind of inversion of the social hierarchy as they see it.
Yeah.
So it's not egalitarian at base.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So let's talk about the title of your book, Beyond Woke. So can you explain what you mean by beyond woke and why it's important?
Sure. It would be important to say that, first of all, that phrase is used by the woke crowd themselves. And I was trying to fool a few of them into buying the book, frankly. They mean by it sort of like a supercharged hyper wokeness. You know, I've gone beyond just being woke and I'm really woke, you know. And I am so woke that I know how woke you are and you're not woke enough and so on and so forth. For me, it was rather something different. It's kind of like analogous to Beyond Good and Evil, in which Nietzsche's arguing about, you know, surpassing morality. I'm talking about the supersession of wokeness, something that's not subsequent to it, but superior to it, something that is over it, you know, very over it. And I mean by that wokeness is about herd compulsion, a herd mentality, and a compulsion to behave a certain way according to the dictates of groupthink, whereas I don't believe that moral behavior can be attained through compulsion of the herd, that it's an individual matter. And so to be truly moral is to be beyond woke, and to be truly free is to be beyond woke.
Right, right. So that's interesting. In some ways, I suppose, would I be right to say that you may share some of the ultimate goals of let's say, you know, liberation from oppression? It's not that you're against that, but that, you know, this wokeness is something else. It's a herd mentality, etc., as you described. And to be beyond woke is not necessarily to reject, you know, the goals of liberation.
No.
But to reject that whole paradigm or path. Is that
That's correct. I call wokeness woke totalitarianism. Right. I don't think it is any way liberatory at all. I think it actually is very, very, very much an oppression in itself. It's a form of control. It's a form of it's a totalitarian impulse behind it, and it's a way of destroying people. It has nothing to do with liberating anybody. It's a means of destruction of people, of the so-called enemies. It isn't even really aiming at the liberation of the people that it claims to be liberating or hopes to liberate, because in effect they're used as tools mostly to destroy the the supposed enemies of those people. So the real objective is not the people that they claim on whose behalf they claim to be operating. The real objective is the destruction of the so-called enemies of those people.
Right.
So that's really the objective, I think.
You know, that's interesting. In your critique, you're talking about the totalitarian impulse. Because, you know, on the left, I suppose you could say I was a former communist Marxist in the 1980s and 90s. One of the criticisms of Marxism and socialism and communism is that, you know, all right, the ideals of, I suppose, you know, justice and the ending of oppression is great. But communism is in effect a totalitarian ideology, and it yes. actually crushes people and whatnot. So as a left winger, were you, you know, as a Marxist, as someone who wrote, you know, Marxist tracts and so forth, were you also critical of the totalitarianism within Marxism or the communist groups that you were part of?
Yes, I was a left communist, and that is, I was a left or libertarian communist who was very critical of the Bolsheviks and their what I thought was their usurpation of a working class movement and the establishment of a party dictatorship, which is and then became a state dictatorship. I believe that was an actual betrayal of the Marxist ideology, that it was not necessarily the case, and that it wasn't the object of Marxism. So I thought that those people had usurped Marxist ideas and used them to effect a political dictatorship, whereas it wasn't necessary, I thought. I don't think right. that anymore. I think it's always, it necessarily leads to totalitarianism.
Right. Yeah, I understand that too, because, you know, I was also critical of the Soviet Union, and you know, I had aligned myself with many independent Marxists and humanist Marxists. You used to write for some of these journals and organs that were humanist Marxists and whatnot, right?
Right, I did. I wrote for a humanist Marxist website. I wrote for Insurgent Notes, which was a left communist group. I wrote for basically just a leftist group, magazine called North Star, which is now out of circulation, I believe. I wrote for a lot of Marxist groups and their websites and stuff like that. But right. my scholarship was in another area. It was in secularism. That's what I did, sort of para. That was sort of my paraprofessional or vocational work.
Okay. And in terms of let's see, your PhD work and secularization, that's interesting. Does that have any bearing on your essays in Beyond Woke? I mean, because yes. I know you do speak about, you know, religious, you know, salvation and these sort of ideas that sort of run through the wokeness.
Yes. In fact, I level a critique on social justice ideology and wokeness from the secularist standpoint of that they are religious in nature, and that's fine. You can have whatever religion you want. But those religions should not be dominating public institutions, for example, especially in the United States, where there's a separation clause, and they should be identified as religious as such. And I'm basically arguing in different places in those essays, and I've argued this in Springtime for Snowflakes as well, that what we need is a post-secular standpoint. Post-secular standpoint in which we have a supervening neutral arbiter rather than some sort of a social justice arbiter of these institutions, so that they're not operating you know, under a sort of veiled religious pretense.
Right, right. When you had adopted your moniker, the anti-PC NYU prof, were you a Marxist at the time?
At the very beginning, yes, I was.
What I find interesting then is just your thought process, because anti-PC was usually used by people on the right.
That's right.
So you had still considered yourself on the left, but you used that sort of moniker. So what was your thinking at the time?
Well, I wanted to critique, social justice and identity politics, and to critique them from the left, but I was sort of playing with them by virtue of calling myself anti-PC, and I wanted to show that you didn't need to be right-wing to be anti-PC, mm-hmm. that in fact you could be left and be anti-PC, because PC ideology or PC culture, PC enforcement was very dictatorial, and I disdained that. In itself, I disdain dictatorial ideologies. My enemy was always totalitarianism. So, so that's why I adopted that moniker. And then I started to tweet these things. And then whenever, these critiques of like the bias reporting hotlines in the university, the safe spaces, the trigger warnings, the no platforming of speakers. And then when I did, they picked up on it. The newspaper, NYU newspaper reporter, the student newspaper reporter wanted an interview. I did the interview. Within 2 days of doing that interview, I was pushed out of the university. Well, I pushed into a paid leave of absence. I was very strongly coerced into it and then condemned by this group called the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Group, who really lambasted me in these Orwellian terms. It was unbelievable.
Yeah,
it was like a tribunal, and they actually declared me guilty.
like Kafka.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very much so. And so then what happened is I started to see the totalitarian impulses behind leftism in general. And it just, and I recall this in my essay in Beyond Woke. It's called First as Tragedy, Then as Farce, or How I Left Marxism. And in that essay, I recall how it was the totalitarian, underbelly of leftism that lay just beneath this egalitarian veneer that really scared me the hell out of it. And right. It woke me up. It was a trauma. So yeah. I really don't think that people change their worldviews based on simply argumentation or something like that. I really think trauma or something like trauma is necessary for these kind of a gestalt shifts that I had. And I had a gestalt shift. It just all switched almost instantaneously. It was just like an immediate, pivot. And I saw the world entirely differently. It was really quite extraordinary.
Yeah, I really identify with that. We are around the same age, and right. Growing up in the 70s and 80s, to be a free thinker kind of led you to Marxism.
That's right.
It was a kind of outre. It was taboo.
Right.
So a lot of free thinkers went there, but then as you discovered, as you say, underneath the surface, they're not really free thinkers.
No.
That's what you found, is it?
I found it to be absolutely prohibitive of free thought, that in fact you had to embrace, repeat, rehearse, and regurgitate a certain point of view and perspective constantly. And everything had to be seen in the same way, that everybody had to adopt the same positions with reference to everything. And that, there was this whole set of ideas that you must adhere to. And if you deviated from any of them, you were in deep doo-doo, you would be attacked and everything else. So, I found that it was just prohibitive of free thought.
Right. Now, to get back to the book, So the book is a collection of essays that were written between 2016 and 2020. You cover themes like social justice, postmodern theory, political correctness, socialism, communism, corporate socialism. These are some of the things you talk about. Now, during that period, you also wrote two substantial books, Springtime for Snowflakes, Social Justice and Its Postmodern Parentage, and also The Google Archipelago, The Digital Gulag and the Simulation of Freedom. So how does this book relate to the, how does this collection of essays relate to both of those books? Does it give a kind of background to them?
Well, it overlaps. Yeah. It overlaps somewhat with some of them. It overlaps with Springtime for Snowflakes in that I do go over my, I do have essays in there that in Beyond Woke that recapitulate to some extent the history that I underwent at in academia, particularly at NYU. But it doesn't go into the deep theory in the way that Springtime for Snowflakes does. Springtime for Snowflakes is a memoir of my academic career, and that is inclusive of my graduate work. And those are the real, that's the real meat of that book, chapters 5 and 6, very deep, go into very deep theoretical waters to try to find the roots of social justice ideology. In Beyond Woke, I do treat some of that, but from a much more colloquial perspective, language-wise and so forth. So you don't have to have a PhD in theory to understand what I'm talking about, although I tried to break things down as well as I could in Springtime for Snowflakes so that it would obviate that as well. But it also treats other topics, like, for example, corporate socialism, which I really don't get into. That's something I developed later. I do go into how I left Marxism. I do go into more critiques of social justice. There's a history of social justice in there in Beyond Woke, which traces it all from all the way back to 1842 when it's first used by Luigi Taparelli, the Jesuit priest.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more in there. I think it's kind of a nice compendium of works. They're all standalone essays. They can be read in any order. You know, some of them are 2 pages, some of them are 25. There's a lot of scholarly work in there, but it's not there's no technical academic jargon as such.
Would you say there's a centerpiece essay in the collection, or maybe a core of essays?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best essay in there is called First as Tragedy, Then as Farce, or right. How I Left Marxism. And that goes into the history of my departure from Marxism, but it goes into it from the standpoint of reading Whitaker Chambers' book, Witness, and then comparing my experience to his.
Yeah. Can you just elaborate on that a bit for us here?
Sure. So Whitaker Chambers writes about how in the Soviet Union there was this German Marxist who traveled to the Soviet Union, and he was over there, and one night he heard the screaming of people that were being drugged out. Somebody was being drugged out of their home, probably taken to the gulag or about to be executed or something like that, one of the two, and it just snapped his consciousness, and he just said that was it, that was all it took. So I talk about how I heard screaming as well. It was different. It wasn't certainly, I wasn't living in a socialist or a Soviet state. I wasn't living under communism, so to speak. But I heard screams. I heard they were directed at me from the left. And it just snapped my consciousness open. You know, it just sort of, it was very surreptitious. It got under the surface of and past the sort of, ideological steel, iron curtain, if you will. And just penetrated deeply into my psyche and totally reoriented me. So that's really what I talk about. And I thought that Chambers had the best take on why people become communists and why they leave it. And I found that it was very parallel to my own experience.
Right, right. And as you say, I mean, the essays are very long. Like I think 20 pages might be one of the longer ones, and then sometimes very short, like just like a couple pages. In fact, I think it's your shortest one. Congratulations. that really resonates with me, that particular story. Ziad Ahmed, can you just go through that a little? And because I want to discuss some of the issues with it.
Yeah, there was a student, and this is a true story, who applied to Stanford. I think it was in the year 2017 or 18 to become a freshman at Stanford, you know, for his admission to the university. And they on the admissions essay question, what matters to you and why? This student wrote hashtag Black Lives Matter 100 times and was admitted to the university. And he boasted about this on his Twitter account. And he actually posted a copy of the essay, you know, as a PDF or a pic. And it showed that was the content of his essay. And to me, that just utterly underscored what the universities were looking for now. They're actually looking for people to be slogan repeaters. They're looking for people to be singers in the social justice choir. They're looking for people to do exactly what people are doing in these universities, which are running around screaming at people. And it's not at all intellectual inquiry whatsoever. It's complete regurgitation of certain phrases. I mean, that's how base and low it's gotten. It's just unbelievable. Yeah. So I wrote a fictional response to him from quote unquote Stanford University, which some people take for a real response. It's too ludicrous to be real, but it may as well be the answer. I mean, the response that they gave him.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, that whole episode too, it underscored so many of the contradictions of the movement too, because the guy who did it, Ziad Ahmed, I looked into his background because I just found that particular story to be so incredible. And you see, and it points to so many things. Steve Saylor wrote a tweet in response to it, which I thought was great. And he said, you know, insufferably ambitious non-black scion of hedge fund Tiger Dad rides Black Lives Matter from Princeton Day School to Stanford. Hilarious.
Yeah.
Right? This guy's dad was the CEO of Citibank, right?
Oh my God.
You see, now having grown up in Toronto of immigrant parents,
yeah.
I've seen a lot of immigrants ride on the civil rights narrative, right, which I think is totally wrong, right? The experience of an immigrant is not the same as a descendant of an American slave.
Right.
And that whole struggle, is sort of marginalized in these, Steve Saylor puts it well, you know, these tiger children, right? You know, the whole thing about the tiger moms, these very ambitious Asian immigrants,
right?
High performing, very wealthy. You know, so he's using Black Lives Matter,
unbelievable,
to get into Stanford,
unbelievable,
or Yale. Yeah, right.
I didn't know about his background. I was just looking at it from the standpoint of their acceptance of this was just unbelievable to me.
Exactly. And so you see how it's being played, mm-hmm. right? Because now he's just aping these things. Stanford right. is saying, oh, great. we're so proud to have you. And here's this guy running, what do they call it? He's running all these kind of fake little consultancies for Generation Z and diversity and like that are just on paper only and collecting all this money. And he's doing TEDx talks. He's just so transparently fake and ambitious. And this is just the new thing. If it was the 80s, he'd be like, greed is good, right? But now it's Black Lives Matter.
Right. Isn't that interesting? That's a great way of putting it. If this was the 80s, he'd be saying greed is good. Yeah. That's beautiful. Yeah. Excellent way of putting it. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah,
you know, it's just a shibboleth that he's mouthing in order to get ahead.
Yeah, it's just pure naked ambition, and these people at Stanford can't even tell the difference.
They can't tell the difference, but even if it was a black student that wrote that, I think it's a ludicrous response.
That's right.
I mean, shouldn't the essay be an argument rather than some sort of a repetition of a phrase of a social justice, mantra? I mean, it's just ludicrous.
Exactly. And it's going to take all sorts of weird permutations because of this, because it's just playing into the same old power games that we've known about. And this just becomes a whole new kind of,
He's using the Black Lives Movement as a kind of human shield in order to be, it's running interference for him in order for his ascent into the stratosphere of diversity, consultancy and on.
That's
and on.
Right.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. I just one more thing from Saylor, who is very politically incorrect, but he's really good. Sometimes he had a title for one of his responses to this is, "I, for one, welcome our new shamelessly black exploiting, white hating tiger child overlords."
That's crazy.
Well, one of the things in your book too, you have these theoretical pieces that go into a lot of depth in that way. You have some of these like snippets like this showing some of the absurdities in the movement, but you also have and I suppose it's part of your Springtime for Snowflakes kind of methodology as well, if you want to call it that. But you have a lot of personal stories, like your experience at NYU, your reflections on the degradation of the faculty, your history in Marxism, even things like your uncomfortableness with being right wing. And then you also have a deeply personal account of your relationship with Sadie, which was quite moving as well. Do you want to sort of go through any of them for us? Because I think it's even sort of why you took this slant as well.
Yeah, sure. I guess I'll take the bait on the Sadie one. Yeah. First of all, that's not her real name, but I wanted to keep her anonymous for her benefit. But that was somebody that I basically ushered into academia. She was my girlfriend, my partner, if you will. And she was a dancer and a choreographer in New York. And we met and fell in love. And she really wanted to become an academic because, she saw the insecurities of being a choreographer and trying to make it that way forever. And, she had done it. And so I basically translated her dance career into academic terminology, and I basically packaged her for academia, let's put it that way, and helped her get a job at a really well-respected little college in Pennsylvania, and a little private school, and then when she got there she became grew more and more insufferable by the day. She started all these ridiculous statements about how she was a feminist. And, oh, by the way, the title of that essay is called, "Have You Found That Place That Makes You Want to Swallow Its Rhetoric Whole?"
Right.
And, which was just something I picked off the internet, by some feminist, Marxist type. It was basically saying what she would accept for a mate, and they couldn't say this or that, and so on and so forth. Anyway, this really, she swallowed the rhetoric whole, I should say, of everything, and she became insufferable. All of a sudden, she was a radical feminist. She started seeing us, what I call a fainting couch feminist therapist. She became the archetypical social justice warrior type. And it was just unbelievable. So our breakup really had to do with that. It was all coming at the same time that I was coming out against it. So, you know, it all reached the peak at the same time. So at the moment I was my relationship with NYU became very fraught. A parallel to that, it was happening in my personal life. So I really had a lot of upheaval at once. It was quite a traumatic time. So yeah, I read about that in that essay.
Yeah, I mean, and you were very, you know, open and revealing about it, because I mean, even your relationship with Sadie as it started, I mean, your marriage was breaking up and troubled, and you went right through that in the essay, and so you got together in a tumultuous time, and then, you know, and there were all sorts of episodes and ups and downs that you relate. It was a point. I mean, what I sort of got from it in reading it too was that you're kind of showing the personal consequences of this ideology, the way it manifests itself in people's life histories.
Yes. And
causes this severe interruptions and yes, problems, kind of. Is that what you're trying to show?
Yes, absolutely. It actually penetrated my personal life. And it caused a lot of problems. Like, she started to see a feminist therapist during the same time. As a matter of fact, her psychiatrist was the person who is now the head of health services in Pennsylvania, the person calling the shots on the COVID crisis. I can't remember her name. It's a trans person. That was her psychiatrist. Her therapist was also a radical feminist, and all of a sudden her language use all started to change, and so did our whole relationship history. She started using different ways of talking about it. All of a sudden words like abuse came in, and she had never, and there was nothing abusive about our relationship, but now all of a sudden these new words came in, and so she reframed the whole relationship in a different with different terms, and it ruined it. You know, as soon as that word abuse was introduced, that was the beginning of the end.
Yeah, it really showed in a very deeply personal way, you know, some of the insights of Orwell about language, how language itself shapes reality.
Yeah, absolutely. Once the language changes and the words' meanings change, and there's a certain dictatorial use of language that has to be abided by, you know, you're on your way to a very totalitarian way of being, and it starts to alter reality. Absolutely.
By the way, just out of interest, did Sadie actually read your piece?
I have no idea.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know.
I want to point out a connection I see between Sadie and Zaid Ahmed. because, you know, you talk about Sadie being a radical feminist, right? And I mean, the story you present is so rich with detail. That's what makes it so interesting as well. So, you know, she became a radical feminist, but she was a spoiled, privileged, right? So again, she was riding all of this, you know, and then totally. She got onto this manicured kind of university campus that you've always aspired to,
right?
And,
you know,
and she was there, and
she rode my coattails. I wrote every document she ever submitted to her college, all the way through. The tenure file, every document in her tenure file as well.
Right. Yeah, you were, you know, the story goes through that. And again, what I see in that is these amoral social climbers. Amoral social climbers, both in Zaid Ahmed and in Sadie, as you describe her, who are just using this ideology as this is just the thing today. And as I said, if it was in the 80s, they'd be, you know, corporate, you know, greed is good, you know, capitalism is the best or whatever. But whatever it is the ideology of of corporatism today, they're on it. And it just happens that SJWism is the corporate ideology of today.
So Karan, for, let me give you an example of how she was. Like, we would go to a swimming pool, okay, in the suburb of a small town in Pennsylvania. I won't say which one. It'll give away her college and then her.
Right.
And if there weren't any black people at the pool, she would go, "There's no black people here." And I'd be like, "So?" I mean, so she used black people as a kind of fixture, as a kind of fixture for her self approval, her own self esteem, a way of giving herself credits, you know, social credits, if you will, for having the right point of view, for having the right ideology. So black people weren't people. They were just sort of figments or fixtures that she would use to assuage her guilt or conscience, and as a way of having the right identification criteria, so forth. Just unbelievable. I would say, so what? I mean, what are you using them for? Yeah. You know,
exactly. And this kind of the sort of amoral social climber thing that I see in both of those examples, and its alignment with the corporate ideology of the day.
Right.
I mean, you speak to that a lot in the book. Many of your essays deal with what do you call it? Woke capitalism. You have other terms as well you use sometimes. But do you want to kind of go through your arguments with that?
Yeah, sure. So I started looking into this phenomenon of woke capitalism. So why are these corporations mouthing, you know, these bromides, you know, these social justice bromides, and why are they suddenly embracing leftism? After all, let's face it, you and I know the fraught relations between the left and corporations across history, right? So what's going on here? I was trying to figure it out. So I looked at some of the explanations, you know, given by Rostock Thought and who've coined the term, and then others, but they weren't satisfactory to me. So yeah. I saw that there was actually that strangely enough, this new leftism aligns perfectly well with their own corporate interests. That in fact, all of these prongs on the new leftist play sheet or ideological doctrine align perfectly with corporate interests right now. No borders, you know, globalism.
Cheap labor.
The new identity categories. You know, this is new niche markets for corporations. Let's face it. So on and so forth. So I just lined up all of the two, and like more or less in my mind, in a parallel columns, right? And I saw bingo. You know, this is not some sort of just mere placation. They're not just placating these people. This actually works for them.
Yeah.
You know, so that's why I called it corporate socialism. And I thought, what is the ultimate objective here? And why are capitalist corporations actually spewing socialist ideology? Yeah. I'm like, what the hell?
Exactly.
And it makes sense if you think about it, because what they're looking for is more or less de facto monopolies on top and quote unquote actually existing socialism for everybody else.
Right.
And that is a kind of, you know, de facto so-called equality between all the masses and their domination or monopolization at the top, you know? And in fact, that's what seems to be going on.
Yeah. It's a really important phenomenon to look at. And I know other people, like you said, Ross Douthat, is that how to pronounce it?
Yeah, I think I said Douthat.
And Anand Giridharadas talking about billionaires, you know, using charity and all that as a cover as they continue to rape and exploit the world.
Right.
it's really interesting and important there. Another kind of paradoxical thing that you've put together, you know, like woke capitalism, is Google Marxism.
Yeah.
Yeah, you want to kind of go through that a little?
Well, it's very similar, but it's the way that I started looking at why is Google such a left-wing group? I mean, why are they such a left-wing, police agent? Why are they policing the web? Why are they basically slanting all of their results? Why are they blacklisting, verboten right-wing or other than leftist websites? Why are they, what are they up to? Why did they try to make sure that Donald Trump's, the arguments in favor of Trump would be either delisted or debunked or listed way down at the bottom? What was going on here? And to me, it's very much the same thing. Their Google Marxism is just the internet version of corporate socialism.
Right. Yeah. Now, on the New Books Network, a large part of our audience are faculty members, grad students. So a lot of university people, a lot of people who would probably, be on the SJW side.
Hello. Hi, people.
And I think an interesting chapter essay you have in this, which resonated with me because, I witnessed it too as an academic, the destruction of the faculty.
Right.
Just the whole story. I mean, I can give you my stories of how I saw the faculty just degrading over, the time I was there as well. Why don't you just share? I think that should be of interest to a lot of the listeners here. Especially maybe the ones that have been in academia for a while and have seen some of these changes themselves.
Yeah. I mean, there were many episodes that I recount in that chapter that showed to me that intellectual and academic qualifications came to mean less and less over time, and that identities were premium, and that tokenism was prominent. That tokenism was being used to promote people. And I think, first of all, preface this by saying that I think that excellence is found in every category of human being, okay? Mm-hmm. And that there is no question in my mind that excellent scholars can be found from any group. But it seemed to me that there was a hasty use of people as tokens and no regard at all for their qualifications. And I saw people being hired that couldn't write a sentence, passing over other people based on their identities. And then all kinds of other sort of ledger domain going on with people being promoted and hired on the basis of their connections and cronyism and just hideous sorts of, egregious hirings of people, like somebody that was hired that had no teaching experience, no publications, no advanced degree beyond a BA in some mediocre mid-states college. And yet they were hired over PhDs in English that had come from the top 10 universities in the world.
Yeah.
And what was going on here? So I talked about that and I tried to explain what I think is happening and why it's happening. I won't give all that away, but it's in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I could definitely identify with that, and I'm sure a lot of listeners can too. Some of these really questionable hires, and then you sort of hear the contributions they make at faculty meetings or whatever, and you're like, my God.
Right. It's so bad. I mean, they're just, and as I said, listen, I mean, there are really smart people out there, and it really does a disservice to the people, the groups that they're trying to help.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, that to me is the worst part of it, because what it does is shed skepticism. Now, that's sort of a Shelby Steele sort of critique here, It makes everybody skeptical of every black person or every person that comes from disadvantaged circumstances.
That's because, right.
Especially identity categories that are vaunted today.
Yeah.
It makes you look askance at every single person, which you shouldn't do. You shouldn't have this overriding skepticism. So if excellence was the criteria rather than identity, then we wouldn't have this problem.
Exactly. It's totally counterproductive because especially, let's say, a white person doesn't have a lot of exposure in their personal life. Maybe that's becoming less and less now, but certainly it was before, to people from, other backgrounds. And then the only one they have is this underqualified, nincompoop in your faculty. It's not going to, reflect well on their general impression at all.
It doesn't affect well. Yeah, they'll start thinking, oh, I see. This is the best that group has. And that's just not true.
That's right.
It's just not true. So it's a sad circumstance, and it's really hastily done. It's really sloppy administration. It's just the sloppy plugging and playing of social group, identity politics as the main rule under which all of this is conducted. Instead of a kind of indiscriminate search for excellence, which I think has to be first.
Absolutely, absolutely. Where do you see wokeness going?
You see where it's going right now. It's why I call it woke totalitarianism. It's going insane. It's becoming violent. It is becoming cancel culture to the max. See people being canceled from editors' positions at the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, other papers, magazines all over the country. People that make any kind of flub verbally, any phrase that's off, is suddenly gone. I mean, this is really we're in a Maoist cultural revolution of sorts. And a Soviet sort of if you think that cancel culture is new, take a look at the Soviet Union and China.
Yeah,
it's not new at all. Where we're on. We're in a really bad place, whereas it's gotten to the point that free thought is absolutely verboten, really.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that, there'll be a resistance against it that would break it down? Will it collapse under its own contradictions? Will they eat themselves
They're eviscerating the culture. They're eviscerating the culture as it is, right? So we're going to reach a real kind of low state of cultural meaning and potential and viability, whereas it's just going to destroy so much that we'll be left with a kind of ruins, a cultural and civilizational ruins that we'll have to. Then we'll see who reconstructs it from there, right? I think it's just going to lead to a total evisceration of our society, I'm sorry to say.
Well, would you say that there's a message from this book, this collection of essays, that you'd like to leave your readers with?
Yes, get beyond woke. it's both a byline and an admonition.
Are there any projects you're working on right now? I know you're writing a new book.
I'm writing a novel, actually.
A novel, okay.
Yeah, I'm 20 chapters into it. It's probably 25 long. It's called Collective Mind Virus. And it's sci-fi. It is dystopian, but I won't give away the ending. It's about retaining the individual in a realm, which is an individual's who are under constant threat of the self erasure by an overwhelming power structure of conformity and mind and thought control, which is done in this book through technology.
Yeah. You can just get your material from the newspapers now, can't you?
Yeah, that's right. But I let my imagination run, and I'm not even a reader of science fiction, frankly. So I don't know where it overlaps with other things, and I'm glad I don't, because that would inhibit me. That's been said before. I set up the world. It creates the certain constraints and circumstances, and then I let the plot unfold from there.
Great. Yeah. So we look forward to that coming out. You said you're almost finished?
Yeah, I'm almost finished.
Okay, good. So for your listeners that want to get in touch with you and your work, how do you have a website?
Yeah, I know everything can be found at michaelrechtenwald.com. It'll connect you to all my essays that aren't published in the Beyond Woke book or elsewhere. Well, there's a lot of published essays on there. It's just they're not in Beyond Woke. All of my interviews. This interview will be listed. All my media sayings that I've had that I think are quite pithy and interesting. Photo gallery of my readers and friends and famous friends, and so on and so forth. Yeah, Michael Rechtenwald. That's RechtenWald.com.
Great. And we'll definitely put a link in the blog accompanying this interview. But yeah, Michael, I want to thank you so much for this. You know, as usual, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah. Once again, the book is Beyond Woke, published by the New English Review Press. And we've been speaking to the author, Michael Rechtenwald. It's been a pleasure. Take care.
Thank you, Kirk. Bye-bye.
That's all for Politics and Polemics this week. If you like this, remember to check out my other podcast, Independent Thought and Freedom, and subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, if you are an academic and want to get heard nationally, check out my free training at becomeapublicintellectual.com. Thanks, and see you next week.